Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Today's guest on NBL is US environmental law expert and activist William Bibb. US listeners are invited on 8888-74888. Bill, welcome to the show. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. How are you doing?
Hi, mate. It's an honour to have you on the show. Could you please give us a roundup of your legal and environmental journey before and after you studied environmental law in 1976?
Oh, okay. Well, I've been an activist in environmental causes for about 45 years here in California. Currently, I'm president of a nonprofit corporation, and we act as a plaintiff or a petitioner in California Environmental Quality Act cases. So that means that we do a lot of grassroots organizing, and we actually go into court on these environmental issues. I do a lot of consulting with various groups about development and, in particular, nuclear energy safety. But as you know, I'm also involved in the climate change issues. And as a hobby, I do a lot of wildlife photography, and I blog, and I sit on numerous steering committees for environmental groups.
Can you, you and I have both been following the triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi. Can you tell me what you know about the Song's mess at Sanofre and your dad's involvement in opposing above-ground nuclear testing in Nevada? And then when you're ready, you just go on with your whatever you wanted to discuss.
Oh, okay. Well, I kind of got into environmental issues by being born in Nevada back in 1948. And by the 50s, there was a lot of above-ground testing. And my father was a gynecologist who happened to live in Nevada at that time. And he knew about the ill effects of ionizing radiation. So he ended up opposing the above-ground testing. And so I kind of got it. By the time I was 5 years old, you know, he was he saw the potential effects on, you know, human reproduction. And so as I learned about various sciences in my education, I was doing some paleoclimatology in terms of fossil expeditions. And I became aware that the climate would change. And then with the work of Charles Keeling and others, going all the way back to Humboldt, actually, it became obvious that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere was one of the main drivers of climate change. And then it became evident that the automobile was causing a huge amount of that, but we had all the fossil fuels, et cetera. So I kind of came across my environmental interest legitimately, shall we say, and I became aware at a very young age that the activities of mankind were eventually going to intrude on the habitat necessary for life on this planet, and that's where we're at now. But I could give you a little background sketch about how the U.S. protects the environment, and probably have to start with Richard Nixon. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. Rock on.
Okay. All righty. Well, let's go back about 50 years. I was living in Whittier, California, so I actually knew Richard Nixon and his family. And Nixon had some good points, and he united with Democratic Congress to pass laws that altered everybody's experience of almost everybody living here in the United States was affected by these laws. And there was kind of a flurry of legislation through the Congress, and they set up a number of administrative agencies, and they had really large goals, and they sought to restrict toxic air pollution nationwide and to clean up hundreds of streams and rivers and erect a permanent federally empowered environmental protection agency. So that was really a big thing, as we all know now, as they're trying to turn the clock back on this. So these agencies actually worked to some extent. You know, they had flaws, et cetera, but what happens with an agency, and you have to understand a little bit about agency law, is that they set up various priorities, and they know that these rules, these regulations, have the force and effect of law, but they're not passed by the Congress. They're actually promulgated by the agencies. And these rules do cost businessmen less money in the long run to implement than it would be if they just allowed human nature to take over. So an example of that would be the BP oil spill. Had they just enforced a few more of their laws or their regulations, it would have been cheaper in the long run. And what happens is that the EPA employees consult with the science about air and water pollution. They formulate rules to protect the public from the dangers, and they turn them into law. So the American public benefits from this process and the research, and that's kind of what it's all about. And it has worked. It slowed down the effects of the population growth and the effects of industrial society, at least until recently. But the flaw in the system, or one of the flaws in the system, is that a very conservative regime can come into power in the United States, and the Trump administration has indicated by its proposed budget and through its choice of appointees that it's not going to allow the EPA to function like it used to. So its proposed budget cuts billions from the agency's budget, and it rescinds years of the Obama-era regulatory work. And the same thing happened under George W. Bush, but not to this extreme. So we probably have the most hostile president ever to the EPA as an agency, and Ronald Reagan tried to pull the same thing, but he didn't enjoy the benefit of a Republican Congress like Trump did. So this is what scares a lot of Americans, and they've cut billions out of the budgets of all the different environmental agencies. And so how this all happens is the statute was passed by Congress, and it sets up the federal agency. And we have a number of agencies were set up, beginning with the Clean Air Act of 1970 and the Clean Water Act of 1972, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1970, and the Endangered Species Act of 1973. And so while Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes. A lot of the legislation that Congress relies upon is under the Commerce Clause, under Article 1, Section 8, to restrict air and water pollution and protect endangered species. But it is a congressional power that's actually been delegated to administrative agencies. So with with the Steve Bannon group being funded by the Koch brothers and their think tanks, it was the evil genius of Steve Bannon that told Trump that all he had to do was to weigh the economic issues more in these agencies and reduce the protection to the environment, and he could elevate the highest priority as the economy, and then rewrite all the rules under these agencies that have been set up. So that's kind of the background, and that's where we're at now. So it's very discouraging after all these years to, you know, have the government agencies being censored and backed off, and people being fired from these agencies, and science being kind of, well, I don't know what you call it, denied, I guess, denial of science. And so what we have to do is we have to kind of understand the forces that are conspiring to stop the actions of these agencies and to mitigate the impacts, and how that's going to affect, in particular, global carbon pollution, which is a primary factor in climate change. So we want to know who did it and how. And we have one of Trump's first casualties was the Paris Climate Accords or agreements. And that was that had the force of a treaty, or it would have had the force of an international treaty. You have the agencies such as EPA, Department of the Interior, et cetera, and he's packed those with people that are kind of useful idiots. They just do whatever the fossil fuel industries and the chemical manufacturers dictate. And so you just change the rules and the regulations right there in the agencies, and the fossil fuel corporations and their lobbyists are right there. So instead of moving to, let's say, alternative energies, we're stuck on Kong, that's C-O-N-G, and that would be oil, gas, coal, and nuclear power. And if you want to know the who, then you're looking at Charles and David Koch in particular and their think tanks, etc. And, of course, we have our Secretary of State and former CEO of there? Hello? Oh, I guess I had another call. We have Rex Tillerson. Yeah. Rex Tillerson is now Secretary of State. And we have Scott Pruitt heading up the Environmental Protection Agency. And Pruitt was a former attorney general in Oklahoma, the state, and he was anti-EPA. He didn't want the federal EPA to come in and tell all the oil drilling interests and fracking interests in Oklahoma to back off at all. And then we have Peabody Coal Chief Greg Boyce, B-O-Y-C-E. He's another big player. And then we have the Oklahoma Fracking King, who's Harold Hamm, H-A-M-M. So those are a few of the dark lords of the underworld that, you know, create these business and political decisions. And they pose as good family men and beneficiaries or benefactors of charities and the arts. Like you'll notice on PBS programs, this is, funded by the Koch family, etc. And they all pass themselves off as upstanding pillars of the community. But in reality, these men are enemies of life on Earth, and they're really representatives of an entrenched evil that's pushed us past the point of no return. So that's kind of where we stand. And they think of themselves as a generation of, you know, great wealth creators, and they talk about economic progress, but these energy policies pushed by the energy moguls are really crimes. They're heating up the planet, and they just have colossal fortunes. The Koch brothers are individually worth about $45 billion apiece. So together, they're almost $100 billion right there, and they push all the Tea Party agenda. And as we've seen here in California, you know, we have droughts of biblical proportions. We have, you know, wildfire and firestorms, and we have flooding. And it's really changing everything as the glaciers are melting. And then as far as the courts are concerned, the far right wing is now able to kind of pack the courts. I had some statistics. I think they've made roughly 90 appointments, and about 20 have been confirmed. And as you see, these appointments are for life on the Supreme Court and on the Federal Court of Appeals and the federal trial level. And so we also see Congress being dominated by Republicans right now. And the Senate has a majority of Republicans. So our children's future are really at stake, and we just have reckless profiteering as well as plundering. And it's Rex Tillerson, CEO at ExxonMobil, engaged in a cover-up of the frightening evidence produced by their own company scientists about fossil fuel impact on the planet's warming. And they've always had profits before safety or before the people or the planet itself. And in my opinion, this represents an existential threat for climate change based on dirty fossil fuel. The Rockefellers at one time were involved in this, but fortunately Valerie Rockefeller Wayne, who's in charge of the Rockefeller Trust, has divested herself of the trust of the holdings in fossil fuel. But if we look back, as I've been saying since the 60s, and all my professors at UCLA agreed, it's the internal combustion engine. When Henry Ford was around, he was able to drop the price of the Model T Ford 62%. So what happened was between 1918 and 1929, the car ownership went from 8% to 80% between 1918 and 1929. So we then had the DuPonts and General Motors create what they call car loans. So that really financed the growth of our dependence on the fossil fuels. And at the same time, the Rockefellers were undermining any kind of public transportation and electric trolley cars, et cetera. So we became totally dependent on the freeways and the suburbs. And, you know, it gets into the urban development, too, which is another part of my expertise in terms of environmental law, how to design cities, et cetera. But when you look at the alternatives to the fossil fuels, of course, excluding nuclear, we can talk about solar, the photovoltaic effect. With now we've had an 80% price drop in recent years. Okay, so hopefully that would have been swinging our modes of transportation and energy for our homes and industry, that would have swung that over toward a cheaper mode, but that's being fought because the fossil fuel companies are afraid that the fossil fuels themselves will go out of style, won't be economically competitive, and they'll the producers of fossil fuels will be tagged with the actual costs of the cleanup that they've been managed to externalize onto taxpayers and the commons, which is just the general environment. So they privatize the profits to themselves, and then they just dump everything else on everybody else. But the if you look at public utilities, we have it costs about $1 billion a gigawatt now to set up a solar plant. And if you compare that to, let's say, the cost of a new coal or gas plant, that would be $3 to $5 billion. So it's 3 to 5 times more expensive. Now you compare that same megawatt with a nuclear plant, that's $6 to $9 billion. Well, here's the kicker, because wind and solar are not only the cheapest and the safest, but when you look at the back end cost, there's no fuel cost. So once you set up solar, you're just converting the photons into electricity. And you have to still build some infrastructure to harvest and distribute the photon power, but it's a free fuel forever source. And then you get into your electric vehicles, and this is what the fight is. This is what Trump and his minions and his backers represent. These are people who stand to lose, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, if they can't keep us locked onto using fossil fuels. It's kind of like being in the deep end of the pool. You're in an epic battle, and they have your head, and they're forcing it underwater. And
the alternative energy debate for me is like Thelma and Louise talking about putting solar panels on the house after they've gone off the cliff.
Yeah, and if you look at the petrodollar itself, and it's so named, that's based on control of the oil in the worldwide, and so that brings us war and conquest, and then the climate change itself will bring us pestilence, which is tropical diseases and shortage of potable water, and then finally death of the oceans and the soils and our ability to feed ourselves. So we're locked in a battle with Charles and David Koch, and they set up the John Birch Society, they set up the think tanks, they set up the Tea Party, and their whole thing is to oppose clean energy and eliminate any kind of remedial action on climate change. And so you have tax breaks to the wealthy, unregulated pollution, permanent reliance on dirty fuel, and a bunch of demagoguery. And unfortunately, they've also hijacked religion, with the evangelicals voting in a block, 55 million of them voting for Trump. Then you have your dog whistle, race baiting, and this is all under the guise of patriotism, you know, make America great again. So it's very, very unfortunate that the Tea Party has been able to take over the U.S. Congress and block the Obama agenda. And Obama's agenda, as you and I have discussed, was not perfect, but it's a lot better than what we're seeing now. And so if you look at the state legislatures, how they redraw the districts so that they can perpetuate this, you know, we have the voter suppression, gerrymandering, which is redrawing of boundaries, voter ID laws, the allegations of voter fraud, which are false, and the purging of voter roles, and that's kind of the new Jim Crow law. So the Kochs, the Koch brothers put their own people in power there, and they're in the process of populating the agencies with their own people and then dismantling the regulations and the agencies themselves. And we see this in the energy, at the Interior Department of the Interior, and the EPA. So that's basically the politics.
It reminds me of a famous quote from the social critic and comedian George Carlin when he described the United States as being an oil company with an army.
Yeah, right, right. Well, you know, it's so basic that we start with our economic system, and if that is based on, let's say, the petrodollar system, then what happens? We have wars like the Iraq War, and we have, you know, if there's a country that won't give up their oil, like Iran or Venezuela, you know, we're on the warpath against those people. So
petrodollar is a very prescient one as we speak. China and Russia and some of the other larger oil exporting nations are talking about trading in oil in the yuan or the ruble or something else. And U.S. dollar hegemony is fundamental to propping up the Ponzi scheme that is the U.S. economy. So whilst I really like the idea and I admire those nations for trading in something other than in the greenback, I can't help but think it'll lead to war, because that's exactly what happened to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. He started talking about trading oil in another country, and Hillary Clinton had him impaled on a bayonet.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of it, if you go back far enough, you know, the Middle Eastern countries, a lot of them, you know, the rhetoric back there was self-determination is the form of government. But if you take somebody like, let's say, Nasser in Egypt, the first elected, I think in Iran they had Mossadegh, who was the first democratically elected leader in 4,000 years, you know, in Iran. And he was taken out in 1953 by the CIA and British Petroleum and the Brits, and you know, they basically want to get their hands on the oil. And while we were the same with Egypt, you know, any of the nationalists, the people that said, "Look, I want to run Egypt for Egyptians," well, that was not too popular, you know. So what they did is they could tolerate even Islamist governments, but they could not tolerate a democratic government throughout the Middle East. That's what's happened. So, you know, the politics of all that and the Nixon-Kissinger plan to abandon the gold window and, you know, do all that, and then in favor of the OPEC cartel, and how they set up the world is anything but democratic. I mean, it's really a shame. It guarantees that we're going to have climate change. It guarantees we're going to have war. You know, who would go to war over solar energy? Who would go to war over wind power? You know, so I was initially interested in environmental law, and, you know, to protect the commons, and that was a concept that that goes all the way back to common law. You know, what is the commons? And the commons is that, you know, the oceans, the air, you know, the sky, etc. And if you look at rational choice theory, you have human nature, but you have your various ways of regulating the quality of, you know, the air and the water and the land. And so you have to balance on some level the interests of people exploiting resources out of the environment and preserving the habitat for coming generations. And that's really what we're not doing. And so we've just had these people that, you know, let's say ExxonMobil makes $10 billion a quarter. Boeing is quadrupled in 2 years, you know. So everybody is on this big roll, and they're all making a lot of money in it. And, you know, it goes back to a lot of stuff we've had before. We've dealt with in the asbestos litigation, the tobacco litigation. And at some point, if the legislature won't do anything, if the Congress won't do anything, if the president won't do anything, and the agencies are being dismantled, then that leaves the courts. And you see the so-called children's lawsuit. And because the EPA, the Supreme Court held that the EPA had the exclusive jurisdiction to regulate CO2. And the problem with that is it divested the state courts from their power to award damages for nuisance. So if climate change, let's say, is causing havoc and I'm growing crops or I'm in whatever business it might be, or rising waters are, you know, flooding my beachfront house, I can't sue ExxonMobil because the EPA has the exclusive authority to regulate CO2. So with that decision, they have federalized it, and under the Supremacy Clause, they preempted the jurisdiction. And now all the teeth of the EPA have been removed, and they don't really, you know, it's a paper tiger, and they it's just all pro-business. So they have no intention of enforcing automobile exhaust standards or any of that. And they're just not going to do anything to help people. So the theory that's arisen in the children's lawsuit against the oil majors and the fossil fuel companies is that there was a taking of their future, a taking of the commons from them without just compensation, and the government is allowing them to do this. And so these children are saying, look, you're taking our future from us. And when you really think about it, you know, the Republican Party stands for law and order and family values, etc. But they, you know, with their denial of this problem, which I think is just intentional, they're taking the future of the children, and the children want just compensation. So we always have to get back in products liability to shift losses back to those that caused them. So if you market an item and that item is defective in some way and that causes an injury, then the manufacturer should pay for that. So if you have, let's say, a seat, you have an airbag that does not deploy in your car, well, you know, you don't want to figure out whose fault that is. You just bought the car. You're driving it. Let's say it's a brand new car. And, you know, the airbag doesn't work. You know, let General Motors figure out, you know, whether it was one of their designs or it's a defect in manufacture, or, you know, we saw that with gas pedals that stuck in Toyota, you know, and finally they admitted it after, you know, dozens of people were killed. And, yeah, it was a bad chip and something, and, you know, they started to pay off. But here we have a total political defeat by a president who was about 3 million votes shy of getting the majority in the popular vote. So this is very, very disturbing to me. And, you know, the failures of a lot of the environmental law, it was immediately obvious when I started studying it in terms of development, in terms of housing and, you know, building roads and plans and et cetera. You know, you just see no one project with its environmental impact report. They say, look, we're just building one building. How bad could that be? But when you build hundreds of thousands of buildings, the cumulative impact is enormous. And that was one shortcoming of environmental law. But by setting up these agencies and Congress having delegated its power to the agencies, some guy could just step in, and who knows, maybe he's not even a legitimate president. You know, he attacked Obama for being a birther, but you know, he's getting attacked back, saying the only person that really put him in office between besides Charles and David Koch was Vladimir Putin. And if you look at Rex Tillerson, I mean, he's been awarded the highest awards in Russia. He's a dignitary. I mean, this is our Secretary of State. Now, I'm not saying we should have a nuclear war with Russia. I've always been against that. Okay, and I think we should have better relations, but it shouldn't be undisclosed, electoral connections. It shouldn't be undisclosed financial gambits. Like ExxonMobil holds leases on oil fields in Russia, and the amount of cash that could be produced out of that is $9 trillion. Okay, so to me, it's so obvious when politicians get together, and these are all billionaire types, and they have connections like that with foreign power. Well, sure. I mean, Putin wants to get out of the climate change regulations. He wants to get out of the Paris agreements. You know, he doesn't want to have nuclear safety. He doesn't want to have any of that because the man is now worth $200 billion himself. He's thought to be the world's richest man. So, you know, I'd like to, you know, see more of an integration of Europe and Russia and the United States, because I've been through the Cold War and I know that, you know, we all have to get along on this planet. But I don't think it should be, a petro state that where we're, you know, fracking and we're doing all these things. And you know, just for an example, they have these wells that they inject waste in, and they have maybe five different levels of how toxic it is. And people can just take nuclear waste and they can inject it down into Earth a mile or so. And we when's that going to get into the aquifers, right? When's that going to contaminate the water supply for the future? And why do we have to be injecting nuclear waste anywhere? We shouldn't even be producing that. And the same thing is true of the fossil fuels, and we shouldn't be burning those. We never should have. And we really should make a switch to alternative energy. We should have done that, 25, 30 years ago.
It's all about business as usual. When I hear people talking about Russia interfering in the elections in the United States, it cracks me up, because no country on the history of our planet has interfered in more national government elections than the United States. In your discussion earlier, you talked about these people seeming to have no regard whatsoever for their children's futures. I think there's a very good reason for that. That's because their children don't have a future. On the 27th of October last year, the Independent published an article, and then bear in mind, the Independent is a very, very conservative organization. The article was entitled BP and Shell Planning for Catastrophic 5 Degrees C Global Warming Despite Publicly Backing the Paris Climate Agreement. 5 Degrees C is an extinction event. I don't know how BP and Shell are planning for the extinction event, except for to keep the business going as long as possible. And, you know, all of these people in cahoots, they've got their people in charge in the United States and controlling the EPA. All we're looking at now is the same old shit until the biosphere unravels completely.
Yeah, I think we're going to be operating here in the United States, completely uncorked. There'll be just everything will be dumped in streams and rivers like it was 50 years ago. We'll have any kind of pollution being spewed all over the place. And it's kind of interesting to talk to my brother who worked for the Alabama EPA, and they have a lot of super sites down there that are just super toxic. And because of lax regulation, that became the most polluted place on the planet, was in Alabama. So they started to try to clean it up, and he worked there. He used to work for Schlumberger and Mobil for a period of time, too, as a He was a physicist, and he worked in oil exploration, but he finished his career and retired out of the state EPA. And down there, there's a lot of social pressure to look the other way and be a good old boy. And so he describes how if he issued a citation to somebody, then he'd get frowns. He'd go to church or he'd, you know, go to the supermarket. And everybody would really be down on him as this is the man that, you know, put the whole town out of business and nobody has any jobs, you know. So the mantra of jobs, 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 you know, this is all short-sighted stuff. Now, you brought up an interesting issue. What if it is too late on this planet? You know, what if it can't be slowed down? And I think that's kind of an argument that for, you know, if it's too late, we might as well enjoy ourselves now and, you know, use up all the energy haphazardly and, you know, stick to what the infrastructure is, which is oil, and not go through any painful changes. So, you know, and that might be the case. I don't think anybody really knows how quickly this biosphere can degrade, but I think that humans are more vulnerable on this planet than they realize, and they may find themselves, as you say, certainly if it gets even 5 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, I really don't see civilization as being able to continue in its present form, and there's too many people, and that would just be a catastrophe. There wouldn't be enough potable water. You know, I keep up with the climate change studies and the effects of climate on Earth and what it's going to do. And, you know, like Southern California is a lot drier than it used to be, and we get wildfires and we get droughts. And I spend a lot of time at the beach and always have. And the tide pools are virtually devoid of any kind of life as I knew it as a child. And I travel from the Mexican border and I go up to Monterey and I stop at the, you know, various beaches, and it you know, you don't see anything in the tide pools anymore. A little bit in Laguna, and by the time you get up to Monterey, you start getting a little bit of life up there, but you know, everything is gone. It's all viruses, heavy metals. Some people think radiation, but certainly the warm blob of water, viruses, and we've lost the sardines, we've lost the anchovies, we've lost the salmon. We don't have steelhead trout running up these rivers. You know, everything's just gone. The sea otters are acting strange, and you know, you rarely see a sea anemone or a crab or anything. The starfish are all gone. When I was a kid, we had 3 types of abalones. It was just, you know, you see barnacles and mussels growing everywhere, and there's just nothing anymore. And it's like being in a science fiction movie where you're the only one noticing. Like, I go down the beach and people say, "Oh, look, it's the tide pools," you know, to their kid or something. It's like, you know, and the kids just kind of like swear.
That's an interesting observation, because I had some people staying on the island recently, and a gentleman came and borrowed some of my fishing rods and went fishing. And yesterday he came and brought them back, and he was talking to me about how abundant the life is in all the tide pools around my island. And you and I have talked about the tide pools collapsing in the United States. And I think that will be one of the catastrophically disturbing things that will be hard for me to handle. And I've been talking in my community recently about how we're going to deal with the grief as this unfolds. Because I firmly believe that everyone is already grieving, and grief is something that we're all going to need to talk about and form bonds with people who we can talk it through with and who understand what we're all going through. Grief is going to be a very, very big issue from this moment on.
Well, that's all true, and you know, it goes It goes back to... are you there, Kevin?
Yes, carry on.
Oh, okay. It kind of goes back to this nuclear war situation. And during the 50s, when I was in second grade, I was told that while I was in school, that if we were hit by a nuclear attack, what we were to do is hide under our desk and cover our hands. And, of course, the desk would supposedly shield us from when the roof caved in. And then the hands over the face, that was going to save some of our face from the blast effect, because we knew in Nagasaki and Hiroshima that, your face was just burned right off by the blast effect. And so on it went. And so we have learned to become numb, that we're constantly told that we could, if in an all-out nuclear war, there'd be a nuclear holocaust, there'd be a nuclear winter. If the radiation and the dust you inhaled didn't kill you, then the nuclear winter would. And so, and that's just the whim of somebody that, either by accident or somebody gets upset. You know, we have personalities that are very volatile and thin-skinned, like the guy in North Korea or Donald Trump. And so these people, our life is just in their hand. So how can we develop our emotions normally, knowing that at any second some madman, whether it's a Dr. Strangelove or whatever, the Cuban Missile Crisis, how do we know that we're not going to die in a second? Okay, so, it's eat, drink, and be merry, ignore climate change, because that's going to take maybe, 5-10 years to really destroy civilization. So, it's like the last days. You see these movies before the pyroclastic cloud destroyed Pompeii. And even as the volcano, started up, people thought, hey, the party's not over, And then they realized, and you see the people that were, kind of buried in ash and, preserved in lava, et cetera. So, it turns out that we're kind of in the last days of the empire anyway. Our economy is collapsing in many ways. We're competing with other large powers. And, we're under the cloud of a nuclear war at all times. We're not able to have feelings normally. Like when I was a child, I was only like 7 years old. And yeah, they're saying you could be killed at any time with a nuclear bomb. Be ready, be tough, and protect your face. And and when you go through these traumas, these collective traumas that our civilization has created, climate change, people are numb to that. That's why they don't care. They go, yeah, well, we know we could go up in a nuclear holocaust. In fact, the odds are that we will. If you listen to Daniel Ellsberg, these people are completely crazy. He had the documents along with the Pentagon Papers. And, we live in a system where it's all about, don't let socialism and communism take your money. Right, and that's why they supported Hitler, because he was the bulk word against communism, and then he went out of control. So, what are you going to do with a race that is progressed technologically beyond its capacity for wisdom? That's what I see. So I see a lot of numbing.
Last year I had Daja Mail, the staff reporter from truthout.org, staying with me at my house. And it was around the time when the trumpet came into power. And every day, Dar would wake up and turn his computer on and turn to me and say, hey, great news, mate, the nuclear war hasn't started. This sort of pressure right. has been over my head all my life. And I've hated it, and it's made me an anti-nuclear activist all my life. But what I see now is that our young people have the perfect storm of pressure on them. They have economic collapse, where all the jobs have been exported from the Western countries to effectively slave societies. So there's hardly any job future for young people in these developed countries. Then they have the threat of nuclear war and war generally all around them. And now they have this existential crisis of climate change, which they know in their hearts is going to destroy their futures. This is an extraordinary amount of pressure on young people. And what really pisses me off about the big NGOs and the big green movements and the Greens in New Zealand is that everybody is saying to these young people, you're going to have to fix this fucker. This situation is unfixable, and it is spiraling out of control exponentially, and we're dumping on young people that responsibility. And then when people like me talk about the fact that we're over the cliff, people say, oh, but you'll discourage people from doing anything. The reality is nothing that we can do now is going to even slow it down, let alone stop it. And to put all that pressure on young people, I believe, is cruel and immoral.
Yeah, that's a lot of responsibility to put on their head, because not only are they under the gun, so to speak, of being killed, and it wouldn't be rational. It would be the act of some, you know, mad person that could just simply push a button, and then there's provocations, and there's brinkmanship, and there's weapons that we don't even know about. And so, you know, they have weaponized space too. There's all kinds of stuff up there that's orbiting around that they can fire down on Earth. Like if you take some titanium rods and you fire down toward Earth and they accelerate to a certain point, then you know you don't even need a nuclear bomb. These things will explode upon entry, and it's a way of starting something, and they have laser cannons, they have all kinds of stuff, and their Star Wars armamentum. So I think there is a numbing, and I think we see that with the degree of alcoholism and the opiate addiction. And a lot of people are just saying, you know, how soon can I get out of here, because they're just raising my rent, college. I know a young woman who's going to a private college here in San Diego, and she's an English major, and she'll be $100,000 in debt for a four-year college degree. Well, there's no jobs. So, you know, meanwhile, the discrepancy between the rich and the poor is increasing. The middle class is gone. And for anybody to say that the American dream is viable, is viable for whom? A tiny minority of people who are lucky, you know, if your folks are wealthy and, you know, you can get in on the stock market before it crashes and get out at the right time. But to me, this is not a system. And ecologically, it places short-term corporate profits over any long-term rational policies. And it's a shame. And I feel sorry for the wildlife that's going to be exterminated by this madness. And it's I don't even know what to say. In some ways, I'm glad that I'm approaching my 70th birthday, because it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And as you were saying, I don't see it's going to get any better, because either we've tipped the tipping points of the climate, or we'll have a nuclear war, or the rich will get richer, and it's only going to be people trying to protect their money. And so it's all about the money. It's all about power. So I'm not very optimistic, Kevin. So I don't think the environmental law is going to turn the clock back right now.
Sorry, am I back? Was a little glitch there.
Back, yeah. Yeah.
I think anyone who's paying attention can see that the U.S. empire is in the early stages of collapse. I've been studying the collapse of complex societies as part of my research, and it has all the characteristics of an empire that's falling apart. But the difference between this one and all the others is that this empire has all these nuclear weapons, and it has all these psychopaths. And my fear at the moment is, if anyone's watching the news, you can see that there's what looks like another color revolution being fostered in Iran, and that the American, or the deep state, call it whatever you want, is fomenting problems there again, trying to overthrow the government for, what is it, the third time? But what I fear is that that someone will use nuclear weapons against a state like Iran, and the purpose of using them will be for cooling the atmosphere. I have a blog post on my website, kevinhester.live, about the inevitability of a nuclear winter, and I hope like hell I'm wrong, but I think that that's the way that that'll be the final attempt that geoengineering our planet will be orchestrating a nuclear winter.
Well, you know, they can't stop emitting the carbon dioxide soon enough, and the it's like to change course. It's like turning a battleship around to make a U-turn. That happens very, very slowly. The inertia is so great, and then to go in the opposite direction. And then the persistence in the atmosphere of carbon dioxide for 1,000 years or more, and they haven't even put the brakes on, emitting the greenhouse gases, including the nitrous oxide that they don't even talk about, and they have the methane, and that's a whole other aspect of it. So I think that if they can't stop emitting it in time, and they have no intentions of giving up the profits associated with the oil industry, then they would have to take some kind of efforts to block the incoming solar energy. And I think we've all heard this discussed. Paul Beckwith was talking about it as one of their potential plans of, blocking solar energy. And if they have an excuse, as you said, then they say, oh, well, we just had a war and it's going to be a little cold for a while, you know.
Yeah, just and, all too convenient. Hey, we're getting to the wind-up stage now. Bill, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show, and maybe we'll get you back later on if industrial civilization holds together. Maybe later in the year we'll have another talk and see how things evolve between now and then. I'd like thank AfroZen for his theme. Oh, absolutely, thanks. I'd like to thank AfroZen for his theme music, and Gary Null and the team at PRN for giving us this opportunity to talk about the issues that the corporate media lies about. They don't just ignore it, they lie. And final, I'd like to remind everyone that nature bats last. Thanks, Bill.
Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.